Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Guillermo del Toro's latest film, Nightmare Alley, which, true to recent form, is chock-a-block with recognizable faces. Off the top of my head, there's Bradley Cooper and Rooney Mara, Cate Blanchett, Willem Dafoe, Ron Perlman,
Toni Collette, David Strathairn. The hits just keep on coming.
Richard Jenkins.
Yep.
Etc.
The guy from Mindhunter, the beefy guy.
Yeah, Holt McCallany.
Yeah. Love that dude.
Yeah, he's great. Definitely my favorite part of Mindhunter.
Oh, yeah.
Because fucking Jonathan Groff's character is insufferable.
Yeah, I mean, they're a good odd couple. They've got that going for them.
Yes.
And the what the fuck did you just say his name was?
Holt McCallany.
Hoot McInerney. Really. Makes you feel the insufferability all the more, you know.
Bill Tench.
Yeah, Bill. Thank you, Tench.
That's a character.
What a name. That's Dickensian. Tench.
Bill Tench, second cousin to Magwitch.
Make season like three, goddamn you.
Goddamn you. There was like 6 months ago where after Mank was critically successful, they're like, okay, Fincher, maybe we'll give you the money. And then I haven't heard anything on it since. So just, it's a little frustrating.
You gotta put a bow on the BTK stuff.
Goddamn right. Otherwise, it was all a waste. I mean, the other stuff can stand on its own, but that needs to wrap up. And then obviously I'd take multiple more seasons as far as that goes. But
sure.
I won't get greedy. One, at least. Anyway, to the subject at hand. Nightmare Alley is a neo-noir that follows a hustler mentalist played by Bradley Cooper. His name is Stanton Carlisle, and he's, like I said, he's a hustler. He scams people, starts out as a carny, and then kind of goes off on his own, does a little bit higher class presentation on his shows, and he gets a little too high on his own farts, thinks he can scam the wrong people, and it doesn't go well for him.
Yeah, it's a quintessential noir arc where he gets punished for his hubris and done in by a no good dame.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's just as classic as it gets, but with this carnivalesque veneer, because yeah, I'm sure that's what drew Del Toro to the source material, because much of it is set in and around circus folk, carnies and roustabouts and so on, and GDT just feels that in his bones.
Right. This is his first movie in 4 years. I had been scrambling to think of something since Shape of Water, and I was scrambling because there hasn't been anything. So it's been a bit of a long wait. Hopefully it's not as long of a wait until the next one, but here we are. So
we open with Bradley Cooper setting fire to a shanty somewhere, and then he...
With a corpse, no less. Like, I think he lights the corpse first.
Yes, indeed. We see him next on a train. He nods off, comes to, is wandering through this circus as a patron initially, comes into a tent where carnival barker Willem Dafoe, you know, hurry, hurry, hurry. The role he was
born for. Is he man or beast?
That is the question of the hour. Is he man or beast? Spider-Man. And the man or beast in question is a classic geek living in a pit, living on a bed of straw, basically, being fed a live chicken, which he dutifully bites the neck of after really gearing himself up. You can tell there's this haggard, bestial man-beast down in the pit, but the camera, you know, in Del Toro fashion, circles around the crowd and then kind of cranes down into the abyss. And you see, you get real tight on him when he sinks his teeth into that chicken's neck, and it gets the movie off on a harrowing foot, because you can see the kind of fear factor revulsion, even though this guy looks like was raised by wolves. So Bradley Coops gets taken on Stan. There's too many A-listers in this movie. I'm going to have to start calling them by their character names now, or I just won't be able to. Stan gets taken on as a roustabout by Willem Dafoe and follows the circus to the next town where it hooks up with another outfit. He meets the fortune teller played by Toni Collette, whose name is Xena?
Yes.
Is that right? spelled differently than the warrior princess. And her husband is a boozer named, I've already forgotten.
Pete.
And the two of them used to, once upon a time, have this mentalist act together where Pete was more of the headliner. But now he's soused most of the time. He still has it, but most of the time when we see her on stage, he is under the stage and under the influence. And
yeah, supposed to be feeding her cues, and right. Instead he's just too drunk to function.
So she's two-timing him on top of everything else. She makes she has a sideline in baths. she has a tub, which is a hot commodity if you're a carny, and she charges, you know, like a nickel a bath or something like that. And if you're Bradley Cooper, you get a hand job while you wait. Probably more than that, actually, but the movie, in a very 1940s fashion, demurely fades to black before the real hanky-panky takes flight. There's a lot of that in this movie, actually. I'm going to touch on that later if I remember to. A lot of, you know, irising in and out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's kind of a muddled iris. It's not like a sharp.
It's off-center a lot of the time. It does make you feel kind of just like you're passing out. It's not clean. It is, as you said, fuzzy.
Yeah.
The geek gets loose. Bradley Cooper endears himself to Willem Dafoe, also sort of frightens Willem Dafoe by pursuing the geek into this nightmare funhouse that's got sort of a satanic bent to it. Infernal flames painted on the walls and you know,
devil mouth.
Yeah, and there's a funhouse mirror and a sign next to it that says, "Look at yourself, you sinner," which is a little on the nose for Stan. But Guillermo always lays on the thematic text with a shovel, and most of his movies, Shape of Water was no different. Stan finds the geek, who is more or less nonverbal, feral, and the geek takes a swing at him. I think hits him with a brick or a rock, and then Stan goes beast mode himself for a second, and he has what looks like a billy club or something like that, and he wallops the guy an unnecessary amount, and Dafoe has to separate them. We learn more about Xena and her cuckold husband, Pete. Is that right?
Pete.
We learn more about their old routine. They're full of cautionary tales. Pete is especially. Well, no, they both are. With her, it's more to do with tarot. You know, oh, the cards aren't good. Ill tidings, that sort of thing. And he's in an equally cryptic way. Most of his cautionary tales have more to do with not getting high on your own supply, or high on your own farts, as you put it earlier. Don't start to believe your own bullshit. And don't...
He's got a term for it, and I'm trying to remember what...
He calls him like a sleepwalker or something. That's not it, but it's something to do with the eyes. Shut eye? Is that it?
Yeah, you've got shut eye or something.
Uh-huh. And that's when you take the grift too far and your Long Island medium, basically. You know, when you're like fleecing people and telling them what they want to hear, doing these really invasive cold reads where you're trying to give people some kind of catharsis to do with their child who died an untimely death or something like that. And then it's no longer a circus sideshow. It's something more nefarious.
Yeah. And there is a scene, or it's, you know, really referred to in a scene after a scene that doesn't happen, where Toni Collette, having done her bit in the carnival with this woman who lost a child or a sister or something, has to kind of like walk it back.
Right.
And she just views that, she and Pete view that as kind of their responsibility if the grift goes too far.
Well, and Xena only goes as far with it as she does because her partner in crime is totally out of commission.
Yeah, gotta keep the plates spinning.
There was
no next thing.
So she just had to start spitballing. He was supposed to be feeding her cues, and he fell asleep on the job.
Yeah, for the next person.
So Stan's got his eye on this meek little thing, another circus performer played by Rooney Mara. Molly, is that it?
Yes.
And her act is getting electrocuted. nothing else to it. And Stan devises a way to make that show more theatrical, where it's funny, he comes to her with a sketchbook and he's like, "Oh, I was just tinkering with this one. What do you think about it?" And he shows her, you know, like an electric chair, like, you know, like mock-up that he's kind
sorry,
of
sorry, made him sound like
like Sling Blade.
Sling Blade, exactly.
Drum roll's calling an electric chair, I call a zip zap.
So, in the very next scene, he has built the zip zap. We go from him just showing off this sketch to trying to implement the damn thing and showing some of the other performers how it all operates. Let's see. Stan is also getting chummy with Willem Dafoe while all of this is going on. There's a lot of scenes in the first half of this movie that aren't much more than padding. I mean, they're planting seeds in Stan's head. Dafoe brings him into his abode, I guess. He walks into a room that's just lined with shelves with a bunch of pickled fetuses in jars. And he says something about, like, look at my little angels. I got the distinct feeling like that must be what it's like walking into Guillermo del Toro's house. I don't think he actually has mummified stillborns or anything like that, but there's just a certain pride of place in Dafoe in that moment that made me feel like del Toro was telling me to put my feet up and stay a while.
There was some kind of exhibit. I don't know if it traveled city to city, but it was in L.A. back when I was living out there. And it was like a Guillermo del Toro exhibit.
Uh-huh.
And it had a bunch of his own horror knickknacks.
Right.
From his personal collection. And then also some stuff from his movies or inspired by his movies or related content for like the Hellboy comics, stuff like that.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, the guy, as one might expect, has a lot of those sorts of knickknacks.
What else is the money good for?
Dinosaur eggs.
So Dafoe, while the two of them are just schmoozing, shows him two boxes full of bottles, little bottles, like moonshine or something or other for imbibing. And then the other box is full of formaldehyde or whatever they pickle the tots in.
Well, it's alcohol for both, but it's different kinds.
Yeah,
like,
right.
One is like sugar cane. Rum, basically.
And the other one is just pure poison, I think he calls it.
It's wood alcohol.
Right. So you can hear the gears turning in Stan's head all the while, and because it's a Guillermo del Toro movie, they're like dark, rusty gears that make this terrible screeching noise, you know, behind his eyes, or at least in the theater of the mind. That's what's happening. That's how it's playing out, because Pete has a crippling addiction to this sugarcane juice, Dafoe's secret stash. Dafoe calls in a favor from Bradley Cooper, says the geek's head wound got infected. Flies got to it. And so they have to basically take him into town and dump him at the Minute Clinic or whatever. And then they go get some food. And Dafoe is very cavalier about the whole situation. Del Toro exercises uncharacteristic restraint, not actually showing us maggots squirming around inside the cranial situation, whatever it may be. He does not shy away from that sort of thing. Ordinarily, we get a lot of that near the end of this movie. Broken noses and partially severed ears and so on. So over dinner, Dafoe tells Stan all about Clem. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Clem tells Stan how you hook a geek and get him to keep putting on the show and keep biting the heads off live chickens. Basically, you find a wino, a tramp, someone who's completely destitute, and you tell him it's a temporary gig, and then you get him hooked on this opium tincture, and you give him the Mickey Finn and get him craving it and coming back for more, and then you've got a man beast in the making. then you can
man or beast.
Yeah, and then you can make him live like a chimp, basically, in a
right.
cell, which is how this guy was living before they dumped him in a rainy alleyway outside of a hospital somewhere in town. Stan tries to sneak a peek at Pete's little black book full of all the tricks of the trade, because he's sort of become Pete's protege at this point. And Pete comes to, wakes up, and you can like smell the booze on David Strathairn's breath. This whole scene, this is when he starts ranting about being a shut-eye and basically giving a deathbed warning practically from beyond the grave. It's got that kind of import. Next thing you know, Pete's dead, and we suspect that it wasn't the sugarcane stuff he was sipping on that last time. Because Stan goes and fetches him a bottle. And then next morning he's dead as a doornail. Probably the other stuff.
Probably. So Stan has been trying to talk Molly into leaving the circus. Bruno, the strong man, played by Ron Perlman, who else, is very protective of her newer dad, I guess. And so he's the surrogate father who's looking out for her and doesn't trust Stan as far as he could throw him, which admittedly would be kind of far.
A good ways, yeah. Although, people would pay to see that.
Although B. Coops is not small.
No.
Not like the Major, who is actually a little person.
Yes, is the other half of the double act with Ron Perlman. It's the right. Major and Bruno, was that yes. right?
So anyway, Stan is trying to take Molly away from the carnival, kind of under Bruno's nose. Eventually, particularly after Pete dies, they've kind of reached the point where it's like, okay, we're going to go. Bruno catches them in the act and starts beating wholesale ass. She stops.
And the Major comes with him, and it's like Polanski in Chinatown. he struts in, like he's also going. Well, he kind of incapacitates Rooney Mara, so I guess he pulls his weight in that sense. But yeah, the two of them are a pair of toughs, an unlikely pair, but they make a strong impression.
But nevertheless, they do hit the road, off to bigger and better things.
Yeah, and from here the movie kind of ends and then starts up again. I mean, you can almost hear the projector winding down. There's a long shot in terms of distance and duration of the carnival after they drive off. And then there's another fuzzy off-center Iris Inn. And cut to 2 years later, they're in much more posh environs. They've taken their grift to the next level. They're doing their mentalist act in front of a bunch of
Pete and Xena's mentalist act, as the case may be.
Yeah, right.
Because he's taken the book.
Right.
Even after offering it back to Toni Collette, she turns it down, doesn't want anything to do with it.
Well, that's a trick of his throughout the movie, is, you know, class. It's con artistry 101. He even says,
you know, you gotta leave money to get money.
Yeah, you gotta leave money on the table to make yourself look trustworthy, and then they'll just give it to you.
Right. Sure enough. But yeah, they're doing their act center stage at some nightclub or other in the big city. And it seems to go fine to our eyes, but he's kind of chiding her as they're getting off stage because apparently she screwed up a cue or something.
Yeah, there's this elaborate system of spoken code, basically, like a cipher between the two of them, where depending on how she formulates the question, focus on the object in my hand, if she says the word object as opposed to item, that connotes
focus as opposed to consider, or
yeah,
whatever.
Right, exactly, consider the item in my hand,
or
then
emphasis on different words.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's all an elaborate scheme. Basically, the trick is to identify a particular item in all of its detail, more or less, and suss out from there its import.
Yeah, because Stan is blindfolded. She can see the thing. And so she is basically describing it to him, albeit in code.
In code,
she's
yeah.
saying, you know, it's old, or it's new, or it's...
It's an old beat-up wristwatch.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. So... The act is sabotaged by Cate Blanchett, this mysterious blonde femme fatale, who insists on doing her own talking, which obviously scuppers the whole thing. She is holding up her purse. She wants Bradley Cooper, Stan. She wants Stan to tell her what is in her purse. And I could have sworn that she was in on the hustle, because he does the damn thing. And it's nigh supernatural. He takes the blindfold off and says, you know, madam, what is the meaning of this? And then proceeds to eviscerate her, basically. He tells her that inside the purse, in addition to lipsticks and a checkbook and so on, all the usual suspects, there is also a petite, little, dainty, pearl-handled pistol. And then she goes back to her table after he's produced the pistol and shown it to everyone. And then he keeps laying into her and sort of just opening her up like a cantaloupe.
You know, just evoking mommy issues and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And he had been in the middle of pulling his act on this old man.
Yes.
Something about his dead son.
And then he pivots and resumes fleecing the old-timer who buys it hook, line, and sinker.
For which Rooney Mara, after the show wraps up, is chastising him, like, you can't do the spook show, and you gotta give him the brush off, or whatever their fucking code is. You
right.
know, basically, you gotta walk it back, like Xena did earlier. It's gonna go bad otherwise.
Yeah, he does not walk it back, because he goes out to talk to the guy after the show. Is a judge, Judge Kimball is the name, and he's hot shit, well-to-do, and so Bradley Cooper gets dollar signs in his eyes and says, sure, I'll do a private consultation. I would love to come to your home and speak to your wife and take you for everything you're worth.
Right.
So Rooney Mara, of course, is none too happy about that. Now the second leg of Stan's journey to hell really, really takes off. He falls in with the Cate Blanchett character, whose name is Lilith something.
Ritter.
She's a psychiatrist or
psychologist.
Shrink or yeah, therapist.
Doctor.
Yes.
Ritter. Yes.
Dr. Ritter. And the judge's wife is a patient of hers, so she and Stan concoct this scheme where she's going to feed him personal information that will then furnish his readings, and he'll pretend to just divine these things during his seance bullshit, which he proceeds to do. And he persuades the judge and Mrs. Judge that their son, who died in, I guess, World War One,
yeah,
is at peace and knew no pain and is
eagerly
looking forward,
awaiting them
yes.
being reunited in the afterlife.
Yes. And they are very pleased to hear this, the wife especially. Dr. Ritter starts picking Stan's brains more and more, gets him on the couch, and just, like, sucks the meat off the bone, you know, psychologically speaking. It's like when a cartoon character puts a whole turkey leg in their mouth, and, like, only the bone comes out clean and white. It's like, you know, there's never been a good, I guess the TV show does the most of this, and the TV show is good, but there's never been like a really 10 out of 10 depiction of Hannibal Lecter, the psychiatrist.
Mm.
And this is, I feel like, one of the closest scenes, the best execution of that idea, where the person doing the head shrinking is obviously not to be trusted with, you know,
right.
You do not want that, As Jack Crawford says, and I think Silence of the Lambs, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head. She unpacks a bunch of stuff to do with his upbringing. His dad was a drinker. He doesn't drink, never touches the stuff.
Well, not for long.
Yeah, not for long. Again, it's part of his descent into hell. And one other thing that she susses out of him is that his dad was this kind of hard-drinking hypocrite who talked about Jesus a lot. Was he supposed to be a pastor or a preacher or something?
I don't think they necessarily imply that.
Stan says that, you know, he would feed people a line of bull about God and religion and so on, but he didn't believe it himself or something like that. But the irony there, of course, and Guillermo, as is his wont, lays it on real thick, is that Bradley Cooper gets more and more Elmer Gantry with each of his readings from here on out.
Right.
Talking about, especially with his next client, who gets a tip from the judge and solicits his services. Next client is a bad hombre, and we know this because his name is Ezra Grendel. And I heard Grendel the first time, and it's like, you might as well just call him Elias Babadook at that point. It's just, he just sounds so monstrous. You know, is he man or beast? Ezra Grendel. So, Stan, over the protestations of the shrink, Stan goes out to Grendel Manor and gets hooked up to a polygraph machine in a very suspenseful sequence because they're trying to see if he's the genuine article. And with a couple of tidbits from his partner in crime, from Cate Blanchett, he manages to convince them that he is, well, them, really just Ezra. Ezra's second in command, his muscle, the guy from Mindhunter, is not buying it.
Not at all. And neither really is the polygraph guy.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, they ask the baseline questions, and then he asks him, like, are you a true mentalist? Yes.
Yeah, and it's like the scene
needles,
from
going
Meet the Fucking
shit.
Parents, where De Niro's, like, grilling Ben Stiller. It's just all over the map.
And Bradley Cooper, after, like, two of these questions, immediately plows it to, wait, before we go on,
there's a presence,
and then he levels out his reading.
Yeah, because he gets back in the zone, and he's high on his own farts, and he believes his own bullshit. And so then, yeah, the line, as you said, levels back out, because in some warped way, he feels like he is telling the truth, even though he doesn't have these powers, and he knows he doesn't have these powers.
Well, yeah, and not to mention also that
he knows for a fact that it's true.
The past events that he's referring to are true, even if the presence of some spirit is a fiction.
And the past events he's alluding to have to do with the great love of Grindel's life, who was a woman who miscarried, and it was his fault. He's a serial abuser of women, as we learn later, but the exact circumstances never come to light. But he mistreated her. He was bearing his child. She died. Kid died. And then he didn't claim the body, and she wound up in a pauper's grave somewhere. Her name is Dory, and so he's been mourning her ever since. So to the extent that he has a conscience, you know, his conscience has been torturing him.
Right.
And so he wants to be absolved. So here we get the Elmer Gantry bit even more. Now the end game starts to take shape. So what Grendel wants more than anything is to...
You just called him Grendel.
Look, they might as well have fucking called him Scylla and Charybdis.
Charlie Murderface.
What he wants more than anything is to lay eyes on Dory again. And fucking Elmer Gantry says, of course, we can make that happen. And he enlists. And it's such a harebrained scheme. It's such a bad idea. And that's not a criticism of the movie, believe it or not, because the fact of it being such a bad idea sort of
is the point.
Yeah, it makes it seem that much more hubristic. That's a word, right? Hubristic?
Yeah,
whatever.
We'll go with it.
So the plot that Stan devises is that Rooney Mara, Molly, who's the public face of their double act, you know, the two of them together, is going to get Molly to impersonate Dory and just trust that Grindel behaves himself and doesn't get too close or look at her for too long. They're going to dress her up in this old-timey turn-of-the-century way, and with blood on her hands and her stomach. So hopefully Grindel will avert his eyes. That's the idea anyway. But it's like, well, more on that after the break. So obviously this goes catastrophically wrong. They meet up in this snowy field, the three of them. Molly comes out of the darkness, walking real slow, bloody hands outstretched, looking very Crimson Peak in her old-timey attire. And Grindel is having an emotional breakdown. And Richard Jenkins is so good in this role because it's the kind of thing where his volatility has been stressed by the Cate Blanchett character. And so with seeing him cry, it's actually scarier than when he's stoic, because you know that when he sees the rug being pulled out, like the fact that he's showing vulnerability is going to make him that much more irate when, right, when the other shoe drops.
Yeah,
which it does almost immediately.
Yeah, he's like sobbing and saying, like, you dirty motherfucker.
You
I'm
dirty
going,
motherfucker.
I'm going to ruin you. And he's weeping while he's saying this. It's
because
like,
he doesn't, you know,
God.
The idea was that he was going to kneel and bow his head. And,
like from 20 paces away or
yeah,
something.
But, and I thought that they were going to have some kind of obstruction in the way, at least, that she would not only be a long ways off Molly, but that there would also be some kind of impasse, like maybe she's on the other side of a river or a barrier of some kind. But no, there's just nothing standing in his way. So of course he runs at her like a linebacker, you know, closes the gap in no time. And then Molly already had a lot of misgivings about this cockamamie scheme.
Well,
obviously,
yeah. She's been burnt out on the whole act for quite some time, and particularly on the idea of doing these quote-unquote spook shows and taking it
right
further. She's been doing the closest thing she can to calling home. She's been calling Bruno and the gang periodically.
There's a whole scene where Stan has to go to a train station to intercept her because she's left him, and she's left him a note, and he barely gets to her in time. I was really rooting for her to just get on the fucking train.
And then just leave him completely holding the bag.
Yeah, exactly. Because the con is on at that point. He's already pledged to materialize Dory. So it is going to be his head on a silver platter. Well, it winds up being the case no matter what, because the plan goes tits up pretty much immediately. So Grendel starts wailing on Molly, and then just like in the funhouse, the beast comes off its leash inside of Stan, and he beats Grendel to death. And we see the man's face mostly cave in. His nose is gone. I mean, you see the triangular skull-like, I mean, not skull-like, it is his skull that we see under the gore, the triangular cavity where his nose should be. Guillermo is so good at shit like that. Then the guy from Mindhunter, Hoot McInerney, comes running to avenge his boss, and Stan runs over him, not once, but twice. First time he goes over the hood, second time he goes under the wheels, and that finishes him off.
Yeah.
And again, we get a shot of the body afterward and what was done to it, the limp, shattered limbs. So Molly is beyond her last nerve, of course, and calls it quits and bails on Stan. And then Stan is running from the 5-0, and he hops a train, which tellingly is full of crates full of squawking chickens.
Wait a minute, you're skipping ahead. He goes to Ritter's office because the cops haven't caught up to him yet. He ducks around some guys and goes to her office. She's been holding all of the big piles of cash he's been getting, first from the judge and then from Grendel.
Uh-huh.
Because he's been like, hey, you should take half. You're an essential part of the scheme. And she's been tellingly leaving money on the table.
Right.
Even insisting though she's been holding it.
Insisting she doesn't want it. Just doing him a favor, you know, keeping it in her office safe.
So he gets ostensibly all this money from her. She bags it up for him and then starts working her magic on him. And at one point, as he's about to leave, she says, I do love you, Stan. And he's like, wait. It, you know, hits a tripwire in his brain. He's like, oh, shit. Takes his hat back off, turns around, and she's like, oh, did I put it on a little too thick? And he discovers that his bag is full of packs of singles rather than $100 bills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where's the money? She trips her recording device like she's fucking Nixon. She's got microphones in the office that she uses to record her sessions, and she throws a bunch of chaff in the water about, we've never met outside of this. You've been coming here for sessions, and I've been trying to cure you of your delusions.
Yeah, you're projecting this mother role and this lover role onto me, but we don't have that kind of relationship, and you've devised this whole fever dream, basically, about their history and about what he's done and his daddy issues and his mommy issues. And she's just, you just see the fucking Iron Man trap sinking its teeth into his ankle
right
the whole time.
So things reach a breaking point, and she pulls out her gun and takes a shot at him. It looks at first like she hits him square in the face,
mm-hmm.
and he goes down. Turns out she just clipped his ear. This is the aforementioned fucked up ear that Matt was talking about.
Oh, yeah. Because Guillermo del Toro was a good boy and didn't show us the maggots in the geek's head earlier. So now he's going to eat double dessert since he, you know, ate his vegetables earlier.
Right. So Ritter calls security from down in the lobby of the building. Stan is trying to strangle her with the phone line.
Yeah, giving her the old detour special.
Doesn't manage to get it done in time and has to flee. And yeah, this is when he's very much the hunted man, cops everywhere. He gets to the train station and gets into a cargo car.
Wouldn't you know it, it's full of crates full of squawking chickens, a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah.
So he curls up in the fetal position in a shaft of sunlight and nods off, and we catch up with him some ways down the road. He's looking very shabby. He's got a hole in his boot that he's planning to patch with a piece of newspaper. Then he just so happens to see it's got Toni Collette's face on it. He hawks his wristwatch, which he's been hanging on to the entire movie, which there's scenes about this earlier that we elided to do with it being from his dad. We also get the reveal, not that we really needed it at this point, that he definitely 100% killed his father. We see it actually play out in flashback. He tears the blanket off the guy, frail old man, in a bed in this shanty, and then
opens the window
in the dead of winter, which is I think that's how Barbara Stanwyck evil stepmothers her way into the picture before the events of Double Indemnity. She like kills that woman that she's nursing.
right.
by leaving the window open. So that was another classic riff.
Yeah, so it's his dad's corpse, needless to say, that he disposes of at the very beginning of the movie. He has found himself at another carnival. He's wandering through, goes into the circus master's office. It's Tim Blake Nelson, who has apparently bought Enoch, the most noteworthy of the pickled fetuses. He's got a big third eye
yeah.
in his forehead.
I guess Defoe's operation folded at one point. He yeah. even wound up with the old radio, which was originally Stan's radio. That's like one of the first things that we see go down. Willem Dafoe offers him $5 for the radio that he's carrying around. So things have truly come full circle.
Stan tries to pitch him on the idea of, like, I have a mentalist act and I could do it. And he gets too close and the guy smells piss on him, basically. He's like, nah, I don't want any drunks. Get the hell out of here. And he's turning to go and he's like, wait. Carney to Carney, come have a drink with me. And then he has a sales pitch for Stan.
Wouldn't you know, yeah. I think it's funny that the guys sitting in front of us after the credits started rolling, one of them turned to the other and said, I just saw that twist coming half an hour ago. And I thought, well, so did I, pal, but that's part of the pleasure, you know,
right.
of a movie like this.
This is not a twist as in what the twist.
No, it's like knowing who killed Oedipus's father, you know, it's exactly, it's not the Sixth Sense. It's something else.
Yeah. The pleasure of the twist is not in the surprise.
Right.
In fact,
it's literally a twist in that it's cyclical and it's got this Ouroboros shape where he, you know, that's why it lingers on the shot of the geek at the beginning, gearing himself up to do in the chicken. And then the movie ends on Bradley Cooper's face as he acquiesces to this air quotes, massive air quotes, temporary geek gig.
Yeah, I was born for this. And then he proceeds to manically laugh cry.
Yes.
And cut to black. We will be back with more after the break.
What is your name?
Stanton Carlisle.
Are you a true medium?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Carlisle.
Doctor, how about that?
Please lay down.
Can you read minds?
Yes, I can. Under the right circumstances.
Keep your answers brief.
What do I want?
To be found out, same as everybody else.
Are you in contact with the Beyond?
Well, we've had our share of snake charmers in the past. We deal with them.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
You don't fool people, Stan. They fool themselves.
I've given you a fortune!
It's time that you delivered.
When does it end? I want to know.
If you displease the right people, the world closes in on you very, very fast.
And we are back. On the subject of the ending and the twist, it's funny. It was telegraphed so far in advance, and it takes so long, not in a like, oh, this drags kind of way, but it takes so long for that to actually play out that I was almost lulled into a false sense of security. Like, it occurred to me relatively early, and then I kind of either decided it wasn't going to happen or just forgot about it, so that by the time Tim Blake Nelson starts talking about, you know, I might have a job for you, I'm like, oh no.
I figured they would go even harder on that feeling of everything having been prophesied and like doomed from the start. That kind of downbeat noir, like Chinatown cyclical tragedy thing, where I thought for sure that Rooney Mara was going to get the chair at the end of the movie, but, you know, like, actually be sent to the electric chair. maybe it was an after credits scene or something like that. But I figured, yeah, him becoming a geek was pretty much the writing was on the wall, and I am good with that and with it taking as long as it takes. I mean, first of all, in my telling, in my memory, it didn't feel like it took that long because the movie just moves. You know, I skipped over the last Cate Blanchett scene. I was in such a hurry to get to the train car and all those squawking chickens, you know. It's like a nightmare in that I was, I guess, eager to wake up and collect myself. But it does the that sense of there being no light at the end of the tunnel. And even the geek at the beginning of the movie being a vision, this almost tarot kind of glimpse of things to come. I'm constantly, you know, I not even close to the first time that I've invoked Chinatown on this program. I've talked about Don't Look Now a lot, and those are both, you know, masterclasses. This isn't on that level, but it does structurally do kind of the same thing. I'm just a huge, I'm such an easy lay when it comes to stuff like that. It really, I'm like a dog getting his belly rubbed, you know, can't get enough of that shit. I write in my notes, as soon as he made it onto the train at the end of the movie, I wrote, next stop, Geek City. But Willem Dafoe stresses in his monologue over steak and eggs after they dump last week's geek on the curb that, you know, you really have to scrape somebody off the bottom of the barrel. You need to start digging under the barrel to find right. A good geek. So he really does have to fall a good long way. And that also plays into, you know, why it takes as long as it takes. The movie is very long. As I said, it felt like we were like an hour into it when they left the circus. Might have been more like 40 minutes or so. But I wasn't kidding when I said, like, it felt like the movie stopped and then started again. It is like getting two movies for the price of one.
Yeah.
And your ass feels it. I mean, it feels like a double feature in that way, at least if you're sitting in an uncomfortable chair. But I wasn't upset about it. Frankly, if like he'd made it onto the chicken train, and there'd been another fuzzy off-center Iris, and then we'd picked up with him and had another feature-length movie of him falling the rest of the way down the food chain. I wouldn't want 2 whole hours of him biting the heads off chickens.
Sure.
Or anything. I think it speaks to the power of the ending that you don't need to show him biting the head off even one solitary chicken. It's just there in his eyes. He knows what's in store for him.
Yeah, he looks way too much like the first geek.
Yeah.
Shaggy beard, crazy gleam in the eye, flashing teeth. I mean, it's just very off-putting in the best way.
There's a good deal of what I guess you could uncharitably call padding, and I think I talked about this during the plot rundown, especially in the first stretch when you're still in the circus. I think Del Toro just loves that environment so much, he kind of can't get enough of it. And I feel the same way, too, by and large. There's a lot of the camera just lingering on this or that sideshow. There's a very good one, like a spider woman. It's just a woman sticking her head through a hole in a wall, basically. But it's done very well, you know, to trick the eye. She's sitting atop this writhing, muppety kind of arachnoid body and saying, you know, don't be like me, heed my warning, as her 8 hairy legs are kind of gesticulating. And next to her, there's a sign that says, why was she born? Very good. A lot of great signage in this movie. That's what the biz is all about.
The sign that I noticed in the ending carnival, something like Beefy Billy.
Yeah. good moniker goes a long way. Speaking of that carnival environment where Del Toro is most at home, I think my favorite production design detail in the whole movie is in the nightmare hell house at the beginning where he, or, you know, towards the beginning when he almost beats the geek to death. He's hunting for him. And the red canvas of the tent housing the fun house is sort of rippling in a breeze. And there's this rhythmic, almost breathing sound. It's like he's inside a whale's lung. it's like he's in the belly of the beast, you know, man or beast. And it just he's already in hell, you know? I mean, it couldn't be more overt. He goes into the mouth of a devil in order to have this confrontation. It's like Luke and Vader in the cave on Dagobah, you know?
Yeah.
When he almost kills this geek. That's you. It's your, you know, it's Luke's face behind the mask in that scene because they are one and the same. And it's because Satan already has this guy in his clutches, and the production design is screaming that at you. Look at yourself, sinner. More good signage. Just shovels and shovels of extremely on the nose thematic text, but it's usually, virtually always, with Del Toro done with enough pizzazz and enough flourish, and the writing is just of a high enough caliber that it's not like nails on a chalkboard. It's a miracle, frankly. It's a carnival freak show unto itself that that he can get away with it as often as he does, because he really has a penchant for it. You get it with all of the Elmer Gantry talk, where Stan doesn't appear to realize that he's becoming his father, talking about cleansing Grendel's soul and so on. You get it with just half the shit that comes out of people's mouths, you know? You get it with Cate Blanchett a good deal, although that's one of the perks of staging a scene inside a psychiatrist's office. You can just say the subtext out loud because you're delving into someone's psyche.
Right.
Speaking of Cate Blanchett's office, probably my second favorite bit of production design was that Nixonian tape machine of hers, because the first time she fires it up, it makes this almost like this kind of this rumble as it and it's like she's got a big purring panther in the corner of the room that's just kind of contentedly humming the whole time they're talking to one another. And I thought, okay, so surely the tape is to get it's to get Stan to incriminate himself somehow, and she's going to use that to sell him downriver. But that it's the exact inverse of that. The utility of the tape for her is to record the version of events where he's just out of his mind and she's sticking to her psychiatrist role without crossing any professional boundaries, which she otherwise does flagrantly with these criminal schemes and so on. And she's just like a complete cipher, which is, I think, kind of a flaw, just because her betrayal doesn't make a whole lot of sense. She doesn't need the money. I mean, I think she does it just to humiliate him and to fuck up his life because he humiliated her with the cold reading when they first met.
Yeah, but it doesn't, the movie doesn't do a good job of tying those two things together.
Well, like, she invokes the word powerful, which comes up more than once. He says that you like the gun because you think it makes you feel powerful, but you're not powerful now, are you? And that, you know, that's when he's laying into her.
I guess that's true.
And then that she somehow echoes that, I think, right before she shoots him with the gun, you know. Right. So that puts a nice bow on it. But she is still just kind of evil for evil's sake. I mean, he says you don't need the money, which is true. And that was kind of what I thought from the beginning.
And then she says it's not about the money. Like, yeah, she confirms it.
And you know, being evil for evil's sake and being kind of a cipher is a femme fatale trope, so I can live with it. But it is something that raised my eyebrow from the very beginning of them getting up to no good together. It's like she is already doing basically what he's proposing they do, but she's doing it completely legally. She's charging, you know, God knows what an hour for these very wealthy men to unburden themselves. And she doesn't have to purport to be anything other than what she is. She doesn't have to claim that she talks to spirits or anything. And she has to give him details ferreted out of those therapy sessions in order for his con artistry to even get off the ground. But she really doesn't need him at all. And she kind of appears to only be going on along with it because she finds him attractive and interesting. And ultimately, it's revealed that she was playing him.
But again, for what? Just for kicks? Just to,
it sure seems that way.
Get revenge for a relatively minor slight as far as things go.
Well, every character in the movie is a con artist. And it's just kind of the moral universe that the movie... It's like everywhere Bradley Cooper looks, he sees a distorted funhouse reflection of himself.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, for all of the other con artists in the movie, it is about the money.
Right, right.
And so the fact that that's not the motivator for her means that it's just a complete mystery.
Well, at the end of the day, she does send him packing with a briefcase full of singles. So on some level, it is about the money. And she even uses his trick, the whole, like, you gotta leave money on the table to get paid. She pretends to not care about it. On some level, she must care. But I think mostly she wants to see his ear hanging by a thread.
Yeah, it's still... I don't know. Like you say, the money still has to matter to her, but it, nonetheless, the ending of that segment plays out in a way that isn't fully convincing to me, or just doesn't play right in my head.
Well, all of the evil schemes are fairly out there. I mean, none more so than the Dory manifestation plot. Right. It was like when Rooney Mara comes out of the snow with the blood on her hands, it was... You know, and I don't invoke this movie lightly. You basically can't invoke this movie lightly because it has such a reputation. I was getting like a little frisson of like vertigo feelings, you know, like that kind of, and the whole second half of this movie is like watching a version of Vertigo from Gavin Elster's perspective as he decides like how he's going to absolutely ruin Jimmy Stewart. You know, it's like, wait, I'm sorry, the plan is to what? You're going to, Kim Novak's going to do, when? With the, at the top of the, are you sure? Like, there's, it seems like there's a much less convoluted way to do this. But it's, but it gives you that kind of dizzy, like, it is just dream logic after a certain point. It's, the word nightmare is right there in the title. It doesn't have to make perfect sense. And that's true of the Kate Blanchett heel turn as well, but I agree that they didn't stick the landing there as well as they could have. This despite the fact that Kate Blanchett is probably the MVP of this whole show. I liked her and David Strathairn about equally, but he's in the movie a good deal less than she is.
Yeah, not for very long.
But they're all great. Great cast.
Yeah, like you say, Richard Jenkins in the role of Grindel is pretty top notch.
Yeah, well, and it couldn't be farther removed from the role that he had in Shape of Water, where he was very mild mannered and
complete
bookish.
Complete 180.
Uh huh.
He's much more like Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
From Shape of Water than himself.
Too true. Guillermo really always hits those villain characters out of the park. He's just got his finger on that pulse somehow. Enviable stuff.
And like you say, Willem Dafoe as a carnival barker is the role he was born for, a role he was born for.
Well, him and Tim Blake Nelson both reinforce what I was talking about before, you know, where everyone is a con artist all of the time. I mean, part of how you hook a geek, and this is the part that Dafoe really seems to relish. He puts a lot of emphasis on it over their steak and egg dinner. He says that you basically have to tell them to get lost. And then you soften right at the last second. Well, I might have something for you. And that's exactly what Tim Blake Nelson does. Get out of here, you bum. But, well, okay. From one
carny to another.
Let me
give you a drink.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like Kate Blanchett with the money, or indeed Bradley Cooper with the money, where he, you know, doesn't want Grindel to pay him the first time. You have to pretend you don't want it. And that's how you reel them in. And that just happens over and over and over again. And so I think the movie is, like, it has some philosophical, well, philosophical might be putting too fine a point on it, but it has some weight to it. I mean, it's well considered.
Yeah.
As wacky as it is, it's cohesive, spiritually, philosophically cohesive in that way. I guess Rooney Mara would be the one exception, you know, the one major exception, but she is the film noir's always, or films noir, I guess, more properly,
right.
Often have that kind of Madonna whore dichotomy to them. And she's the more virtuous of the two women.
Yes.
By leaps and bounds. It is quite, how long is it? Is it
two and a half hours?
Is that all? It felt like three. I mean, it feels longer than it is. And I wasn't even put off by that. It felt suitably epic. I mean, by the time Bradley Cooper lays eyes on the king of the pickled babies again and his old radio, you do feel like that was a lifetime ago that he hawked that radio to Willem Dafoe in the opening.
Seen that radio since before you were born.
Yeah, right, exactly. Because it happened in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Right.
But the movie doesn't drag. I mean, it has momentum, but it just takes its time, and it's kind of in love with itself, so there's a leisurely quality to it. That didn't bother me. Your mileage may vary. I do think that if I were like a robot, if I were trying to be completely objective, I would say maybe it has some pacing problems. Like I said, a lot of the stuff in the circus stretch has no real bearing on anything, like the Spider Woman, for example. Right. But I wouldn't cut any of that. You know, I wouldn't kill any of those darlings. If this movie were real lean, I mean, who wants a real lean piece of meat, first of all? You know, you want a little bit, not, you don't want gristle, but you want something.
You want marbling.
Yeah, right. You want something to sink your teeth into. And that's kind of what this movie is for me.
Yeah, I'm more or less on board with that. I think the carnival stuff at the beginning, for me, if there were, I mean, obviously there's a lot of carnival flavor in it, but if there had been a little bit more stretches of unease, you know, a little bit more like, this is the seedy side of the circus. Not that they shy away from that per se.
No, goodness.
But if there had just been a little bit more existential dread maybe floating over more of the scenes in that milieu, I might have liked it a little bit better.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I think that there, Del Toro might just be handicapped by that kind of like Tim Burton-y, like big-hearted, like these are my people kind of thing. You know?
Sure.
Where he is just maybe a little too comfortable in the dark carnival. Willem Dafoe is obviously a complete demon. You know? The way that he breaks his geeks and bends them to his will. And Bradley Cooper gets away with murder. And there are just macabre elements everywhere you look. But it is a little too cuddly. I think I'm with you on that. It could get away with being as long as it is, or I think even slightly longer if, yeah, there was just a little bit more menace imbued in it somehow. I'm trying to think of how you would have gone about that. It's a cheap trick, but, you know, you could have maybe, well, you know, like when every time that Rooney Mara gets electrocuted, there's never any indication that she might actually come to harm. Because right. This movie delights so much in
the spectacle.
And in showing you the man behind the curtain, too. Right. The movie never misses a trick when it comes to telling you Penn and Teller style, like how the thing was done. It happens over and over again. I mean, there are some cold reads that look completely supernatural. There's one that we didn't even talk about where Bradley Cooper just completely dazzles the sheriff who comes to break up the circus. And he takes a look at his shoes and sees that one of them is sitting a little higher than the other. It's got like a fat sole or something. One of his legs is stunted. And so, he had polio. And then that gets like the snowball rolling. And he just tells the guy his entire life story. Again, pretending that it's being dictated to him by forces.
The spirit of his sainted mother.
Yeah, right. And the movie, despite the fact that it has this mystical dimension to it insofar as it is an Ouroboros, and he does wind up in this kind of doomed Sophoclean way at the bottom of the geek pit. Despite that, nothing else that happens that looks supernatural actually is, and the movie is always at pains to point that out. And that's part of what makes it so fucking long, is that it's not just enough to see the magic trick. You then get a scene of commensurate length where they tell you how the trick was achieved.
Right.
Which I appreciated, because this stuff is all bunk. And it's part of the moral of the story that you have to know it's bunk in order to not be a sucker and in order to not sucker yourself.
Right. Relative to the Rooney Mara stunts, there is dialogue when she's running away from Bradley Cooper near the end where she says, "When I started doing that show, I would get these terrible muscle cramps." And then, you know, I would just try and push through it by telling myself I didn't feel it, but eventually I would have enough. I've had enough.
Yes, right, of you.
But that's so far removed from the shows themselves that it's really not the double entendre that it is meant to be. It's really just a single entendre where it's all about the barely subtext of, I've had enough of this relationship.
Right.
As opposed to, no, it really did hurt doing those shows. It doesn't even really register that way.
Yeah, I guess we could have done with a little bit. I mean, and she's supposed to be this kind of innocent waif, so there is almost something a little magical and incandescent about her, especially in the first half of the movie. So her just taking the lightning like it's nothing, letting it course through her, and then only revealing very belatedly that it actually did hurt the whole time is sort of fitting. But I think that the first leg of this journey could have been made more macabre and a little less cuddly if we had seen her backstage a little more. I'm thinking of like the boxing movie cliches of like, you know, like in a $1 million baby kind of thing where they take the hand wrappings off and you see like the skin on the knuckles is all bruised and peeling, or like they have to ice their hands, that, you know, the kind of the grind, the unglamorous reality of doing this kind of work. Ron Perlman has a good line about that where he talks about how his knees are totally fucking busted.
is like, always with the knees.
So it is there. I guess we just want that dial cranked up a little bit, because the circus stuff takes up, and I think I've said this before on the podcast, it just takes up an awkward amount of the movie.
Right.
It's not quite long enough, but also not short enough. And it didn't bother me just because I found the movie so charming. But as I am wont to say, your mileage may vary. And I think that people's mileage would be less likely to vary if the circus stuff had more in the way of suspense and a kind of sinister layer to it that is mostly missing now, because... Well, not mostly missing, but is maybe a little deficient, I think, because Guillermo del Toro wants to live in that circus.
In the circus.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And on the flip side, in the second half, because we know so definitively that the act is all bogus, there's a little bit less energy in just the scenes of Stan doing the act.
Uh-huh.
There isn't that sense of cosmic dread or the spirits being unsettled or whatever. And, you know, you wouldn't want to lean too far into that, because, like, we are definitely supposed to be in on the fact that it's all horse shit. But if we could have just amped that up a little bit, made ourselves forget for just, like, half a second, like, oh, this is a pretty good trick. Oh, yeah, right. No, this is crap.
Yeah, right.
And that's not really there.
Well, it becomes much more noir in the second half, obviously, with the femme fatale coming in and the con artistry of it all, the actual criminal plots and the backroom deals and all that. So then I think the suspense more has to do with, okay, obviously this is going to go spectacularly wrong. It's going to backfire on them. The question is when and how. And I think Del Toro mines that question for a great deal of suspense. The guy sitting in front of us read the writing on the wall, same as us, and I think got fed up. at least if that one offhanded remark was any indication.
Right.
And I went along for the ride. I think there is just enough of that mystical element to kind of buoy things. The shot that comes to mind is after, I think, one of his meetings with the shrink, Bradley Cooper comes back to the hotel where he's staying with Rooney Mara, and he sees just this fat-ass white bunny rabbit, this absolutely enormous bunny, in the middle of the hotel hallway. And this is a companion of Toni Collette's and David Strathairn's before his untimely demise, as part of their act, I think. Or, you know, he's associated with the circus folk, and it almost looks like a hallucination the way it's framed. Like, Bradley Cooper is just cracking up.
Right.
And the past is intruding upon the present. But then he walks into their room and a bunch of circus folk have dropped in to swap stories and, read tarot and just kind of carouse.
Right.
But the first time you see that bunny, it does feel a little bit like a vision.
Visions.
Yeah. You got it.
Never be rid of it.
I was a little taken aback. This is my last quibble. All my quibbles are relatively mild. There is a scene where Bradley Cooper and Cate Blanchett, they go in for a kiss, and there's one of this movie's many 1940s style Hays Code style demure fades to black. And I thought for sure they were just going to shag on her desk right then and there. I thought that's what that edit, that cut was meant to convey. But then later on, she shows him her torso, and she's got this scar kind of snaking between her breasts, and he's clearly never seen it before.
Yeah.
He's never seen her in the buff. So that threw me for a loop. That's one way in which, the movie's not prudish by any means. There's certainly violence in it that you could not have gotten away with under the Hays Code.
Well, yeah, and not to mention the hand job, even though we don't, like, physically see manual contact.
Uh-huh.
It's still way more overt than it ever could have been.
Well, and it's not a bubble bath. You got a pretty good look at his equipment, albeit distorted and kind of at an
angle.
Yeah, an oblique angle.
So yeah, that's definitely not code, but right. Yeah, there still is some of that sensibility. You're right.
But you know, I think if you'd gone more of a that's one thing that makes it feel less like neo noir. Because when I think neo noir, I think generally steamier than
Body Heat.
Yeah, Body Heat exactly is the classic example. That kind of thing. If this movie had like a little bit more Body Heat to it, that's another thing that theoretically could have generated more interest. But I wasn't bored. So these I'm just spitballing here for the benefit of the people sitting in front of us more than anything. I was just tickled by it.
Yeah.
I thought the ending was really a knockout. And that's the note I want to end on.
It's just stuck on Bradley Cooper's face and it hits you like a fucking sledgehammer. Yeah. It is something else.
Well, and just that this is, again, Del Toro exercising uncharacteristic restraint. The fact that you don't see him in the pit. You don't, you know, and you don't get any of that. You don't need any of that. It's all still ahead of him. And that's the worst part. He has yet to take the first bite.
And you don't even see the mangled ear.
That's true.
You don't see how it healed up or failed to, as the case may be.
Yeah, well, and he's so shaggy that, you know, it's obfuscated. Good stuff.
So, in terms of recommendations, I'm going to go pretty out there. This is not a horror movie, although then again, neither really is Nightmare Alley.
Fair enough.
It's pretty much just straight up noir with a little bit of horror flavoring because it is Del Toro. But the movie I'm going to recommend is The Blue Angel.
Okay, fuck yeah.
For those of you unfamiliar, it's a von Sternberg film, Joseph von Sternberg. It's about a professor, you know, very, very straight-laced, very respectable teacher, played by Emil Jannings. I don't even remember the circumstances of how he ends up going to the club for the first time, but he goes to this sort of sleazy, bawdy, interwar nightclub in Germany. It's a German film. And he sees this singer, played by Marlene Dietrich.
Lola
falls completely under her spell. Now, is the club called the Blue Angel? Is that where the name comes from? I'm trying to remember.
I haven't seen it since we were in high school, but it made a powerful impression.
Boy, howdy, did it.
Yeah, I don't remember, truth be told.
Well, it's more or less immaterial. Anyway, the upshot is that he falls harder and harder for her, and she is just a complete harpy. And he ends up debasing himself and becoming effectively a sideshow attraction at this club.
Yeah.
He turns into this, like, bizarre crowing man.
Yes, this like, rooster clown abomination. It's really painful to watch.
And, yeah.
So, everyone who's ever had their heart broken knows how it feels to be a rooster clown. just like a complete, even if you're just a sad clown or just a rooster, there might be some dignity in it. But somehow the hybrid is robs you completely of any manhood or self-respect that you might have left over.
Yeah, and the sound that Jannings settled on for the crowing is haunting.
Yes.
And I just, you know, if you're not going to watch the movie, hop onto YouTube and try and find it because it's bone chilling. But anyway, so yeah, obviously the arcs are in some ways similar, although Bradley Cooper starts out as a crook and then kind of gets his just desserts. But they start out high and end up lowest of the low. And that's kind of what brought that movie to mind when watching Nightmare Alley. They both end up in a singularly horrifying, debased place.
Yeah, I mean, debased is the word for it. It's a very solid recommendation. There's parallels aplenty, I think. Mine is definitely a horror movie, but also a little bit out there. Like many of my recommendations, there is only one item in the middle of the Venn diagram that my mind is kind of latching on to. Movie is The Tenant, the Polanski movie.
Okay.
Midway through The Tenant, Roman Polanski, who plays the protagonist, meets a character who is in a very bad way, like full body cast, recovering from some horrific event or another, and then through just sheer nightmare Twilight Zone logic, winds up, spoilers for The Tenant, somehow either becoming that exact person or just finding himself in that person's same dire straits. And it felt like, you know, it's like the lid of a coffin slamming shut. Again, it's that Ouroboros snake eating its own tail thing. It's almost like just the fact that you can lay eyes on your own future and not really feel anything because it's not happening to you. You know, it's like if I were to blithely walk past a homeless man today, and then my life totally goes to shit and I'm homeless several years from now, it would have that same kind of tragic arc. You know, it's like with Bradley Cooper at the beginning of Nightmare Alley, doesn't even poning up the extra quarter to see the chicken get its head cut off, you know, cut off, bitten off, eaten right. off. He looks like it grosses him out a little bit. And he says a couple times like, oh, poor bastard, you know, especially after Defoe elucidates how and why he comes by his geeks. But his heart doesn't exactly bleed for him. You know, no. At the end of the day, he beats one half to death. And then when the wound that he inflicted gets infected, he abandons him in the street. And he has a couple lines to the effect of like, well, shouldn't we...
He doesn't push that hard.
Yeah, no, you sure he's okay? Yeah, he's fine. Let's go get something to eat. I'm starving, you know. Spider-Man. And, so it is, whether it's his just desserts or not, him winding up in that role does have a certain karmic dimension to it. And The Tenant is an awfully peculiar movie, but really just about the Polanski character losing his mind over the course of 2 odd hours, becoming convinced that he is inhabited by the spirit of the woman who lived in his apartment before he moved in. It's, you know, a classic Polanski and paranoia piece in that it's all to do with fear of the neighbors. Repulsion is sort of along those lines. Rosemary's Baby, very much along those lines. Tenant takes that just to the nth degree. And for whatever reason, he winds up in this self-fulfilling prophecy cyclical kind of way. The woman in the room before him leapt to her death from the window. So he starts to get this kind of fatalistic obsession with the idea of jumping to his death. And I've spoiled enough already. Point being, he winds up mutilated and debased and broken at the end of the movie in a not completely dissimilar way to Emil Jannings in Blue Angel, or Bradley Cooper in Nightmare Alley, where you just can't even... I mean, I say you can't even recognize the guy anymore. I mean, that's literally true, because he looks at himself in the hospital bed early in the movie, and Bradley Cooper, in kind of a metaphysical sense, does the same thing when he's looking down into the geek pit. You don't see yourself, but it is you. I guess that's the connective tissue there. It's a creepy feeling.
I just have to say,
Carlisle, bring me tinctures of opium!
Just saying Spider-Man over and over forced me to...
J. Jonah Jameson, a fucking carnival barker if ever there was one. What, are you serious?
Well, on that note, I think we better leave Nightmare Alley behind before we both end up being geeks biting the heads off chickens.
Yeah, well, that suffers in an audio-only medium, I think.
True. Well, until next time...
Don't have Emil Jannings on hand to make pained rooster noises.
I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we're the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Nightmare Alley official trailer Searchlight Pictures, uploaded by Searchlight Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, January 16th, and we will be discussing VHS 94, the fourth installment in the anthology series, and, we hope, a return to form. See you then.